Hola, so. I have to warn you, I'm feeling a little bit feisty this morning. So I brought some quotes to make sure I'm careful with my words. We're returning this morning to awareness of awareness, taking a purely phenomenological approach to seeking to understand the nature of consciousness and eventually explore its multiple dimensions. I mentioned a few days ago that it's largely in the 17th century, that the unified kingdom, the kind of, one could say, ideological or epistemological, kingdom of medieval scholasticism actually fell into three pieces. That is, the whole of reality, that is, the divine, angels, heaven and hell, God, the Trinity, and all of that, as well as the whole of subjective experience, as well as the whole of the objective physical world, had all been under the domain of one king, and that was the king of the church in unification with the state. And then people like Galileo came along, and there was kind of a land grab, as he demanded that the objective, physical, quantifiable universe, that this can no longer be simply under the sovereignty of, or the rulership, authority of theologians. And very specifically, he said, that if we natural philosophers, if we find empirical evidence that contradicts a literal reading of Scripture, then you simply have to reinterpret Scripture. Which sounds kind of reasonable, except that if you own the whole pie, and somebody just wants, let's say, a third of your pie, you don't want to give it away. And so that created some discord. Descartes was one of the first, although a very, again, like Galileo, a very devout Roman Catholic. He did not start, but he certainly took a major bold initiative in carving out another area, and that is subjective experience. For philosophers who will not be making all of their statements about subjective experience based upon Scripture or Aristotle, but on the basis of their own introspective observations. And so suggesting now, okay, well, you theologians now only get a third. Subjective experience, the nature of the mind, philosophical issues, we will be working out on our own, empirically, experientially, and rationally, and then Galileo and company saying, and by the way, we'll take the objective physical world, and what's left over for the theologians is the divine, the transcendent, the supernatural, exactly the supernatural. And that is God, the Trinity, heaven and hell, angels and demons, and all of that. Galileo was quite happy to let the theologians take care of that. Descartes also said, well, you people cover that. And so now the kingdom had fallen apart into three principalities. And as we know, as I mentioned a couple of days ago, we have then a terrific success story for science, having at its domain and with its methodologies, developing expertise, extraordinary expertise in understanding and utilizing the objective, the physical, and quantifiable. It wasn't impossible that philosophers, these philosophers of mind, people like Descartes, it wasn't impossible that they could have recognized what contemplatives had recognized centuries before, and that is, if you want to understand the nature of the mind from a first-person perspective, you better develop your attention skills. Christians had recognized that, of course the Hindus and the Buddhists, but they didn't. They just didn't. Why they didn't, I can't really say, but they didn't. And so the introspection remained at completely a level of folk psychology, and as we know, there's been very little consensus in philosophy of mind ever since the time of Descartes. The theologians, who now have their realm, would be the kingdom of heaven within, the nature of God, the soul, immortality. It wouldn't be inconceivable that they might have drawn on the tremendous wealth of the Jewish and the Christian, even the Muslim contemplative traditions, and gotten inspired by the scientists and saying, well, you scientists are doing so well for the objective, the physical, we're going to match you blow by blow, we're going to develop our own technology, and we're going to draw on the wealth of our own contemplative traditions. But they didn't. They could have, but perhaps the fact that science arose right at the same time of this major psychosis of Europe, manifesting in the witch hunting, and the rise of the Protestant Reformation that was so keen on portraying human beings as the soul of the human being as being a den of iniquity, just really evil, then you will not have a whole lot of inspiration for going into the den of evil. If you should discover anything, you might be burned as a witch. So there's not much impetus for doing it, and then a big penalty if you do it wrong. Like maybe you succeed and you develop paranormal abilities, then you're definitely a witch. So what happened then in this great race The scientists forged it for 400 years, theologians theologized, but developing no empirical means of their own, the philosophers philosophized, but with no empirical means of their own. So by the time we get to the late 19th century and the early 20th century, we're getting more and more bold people like T.H. Huxley and Darwin, for that matter, and many others in the 20th century rising up and saying, well, by the way, now the whole of reality is what we're good at. That is, the only thing that exists is the physical, the objective, and the quantifiable. And the first thing to go is the supernatural. Blow that one off. That was the weak kid on the block, because it was appealing to authority, and that's what scientists were supposed to be good at challenging, and they did to a large extent. But we'll see, it didn't stop there. In the year 1913, the man who was really pointed to as being the great pioneer of modern behaviorism, the scientific study of the mind, using empirical evidence, John B. Watson wrote in 1913, 3 years after William James died and began turning over slowly in his grave, John B. Watson wrote, the time has come when psychologists or psychology must discard all references to consciousness. No more talking of consciousness. He said, moreover, belief in consciousness is attributed, or he attributed the belief in consciousness to superstition and magic. So I've commented that in some respects, this ideology of scientific materialism is like a terrible virus that just erodes common sense. I really wonder whether it does damage to the frontal cortex. That would be an interesting study. But it stupefies. I don't know what else to call this, because this is not some Looney Tune. This was a major psychologist, Johns Hopkins University, I believe it was. I couldn't bet my life on it. 15 years later, 1928, he said, behaviorists must exclude from their scientific vocabulary all subjective terms. Belief, perception, emotion, must exclude all of these now. No more talking about that. If you wonder, this must be so idiotic that we must have grown beyond that. About 2 months ago, I was at Oxford. A very senior philosopher emeritus said, it is impossible to observe thoughts. You cannot observe the face of the mind, of the space of the mind. And then the real clincher was, you don't feel feelings. I don't know what you do with feelings, but I guess you don't feel them. If you thought this must be so hysterically foolish, well, then you can see the 1953 B.F. Skinner said, mind and ideas are non-existent entities. I thought that was a very interesting idea. Which means the mind with which he came up with that idea was non-existent, and the idea that ideas are non-existent, that is also non-existent, so this looked like a snake that swallows its own tail. It hasn't stopped. As I said, this was just recently, this philosopher at Oxford made the statement that I commented, one of the most renowned philosophers of mind, philosopher of brain, has recently made the comment that all subjective experience is illusory. Subjective ideas, experiences don't really exist. All that exists is the brain. Her husband, who believes he's a pea in the same pod, he says the same thing. Subjective experience doesn't really exist. It's just illusory. And I think I might have mentioned earlier, in his billfold, where a lot of men will hold photos of their wives, right? He has a photo of his wife. It's a brain scan. A brain scan of his wife's brain. Francisco Varela, who I sorely miss, I wish he were still here, I think he would still have a wonderful impact, as one of, you know, a renowned, very distinguished neurobiologist, died in 2001, great loss. But he commented to me that until very recently, pretty much even through the 90s, neurobiologists amongst themselves professionally would not even mention the word consciousness. You don't talk about it. If you talk about it, it's over tea, but not professionally. Is it not true that the French word for consciousness is esprit? Or something, esprit? What is the word for consciousness in French? Is what? Esprit? I can't hear. Conscience. Conscience. Ah, but there's this other word, esprit, which means spirit, yes? And auf Deutsch, Geist. So the words can be used, I think, interchangeably, no? Or not? Not really, quite different, utterly separate. Okay? I do believe, though, that... Thank you for that clarification. I like to avoid mistakes as much as I can. We do have this Geisteswissenschaft, which is not simply the study of ghosts. Right? In any case, the great demon for the materialist view is consciousness itself. Because it is the very quintessence, it is that which makes subjective experience possible. It is the very nature of subjectivity. It is obviously not objective, it cannot be observed or measured objectively, it is not quantifiable, and it has no physical attributes, and when you bring every system of measurement possible to observe physical things, consciousness is utterly invisible. That should be a strong indicator that consciousness is not physical, and it is that indeed which makes subjective experience possible. John Searle, one of the prominent philosophers of mind in the United States, has actually championed the irreducibility of first-person experience, and he comments, and this is where I'll close, he comments that for a long time, given the domination of scientific materialism, and he actually is a scientific materialist himself, consciousness was refuted, as we saw with Watson and B.F. Skinner and others, even to the present day, its very existence refuted because it wasn't physical. Like the philosopher of mind that I studied with at Stanford, mental imagery is non-existent because it's not physical. Doesn't matter whether you see it. Ideologically, we'll just stamp on it. So John Searle said for a very long time, subjective experience and what is more subjective than consciousness was simply flat out refuted because it's not physical. And then, he said, another ploy with the rather rise of modern science, as it basically took the place of behaviorism, then it was refuted because it is physical. That is to say, it is simply supplanted by brain function, that consciousness, subjective experience is illusory, like this philosopher of mind I just commented, and she and her husband both. It's illusory because all that's really real is brain. And we have Antonio Damasio commenting that many of us neuroscientists have said, our one goal and our one hope, that's a direct quote, our one goal and our one hope is, and I'll just paraphrase closely, to provide a comprehensive explanation of subjective experience, of course that includes consciousness, using the tools of neurobiology, in other words, exclude first-person experience, and explain it entirely in terms of neural patterns. That is our one goal and our one hope. So never mind whether it's true or not. Let us assume it's true, and then marshal all of the resources, all the funding, all the laboratory facilities, everything, to proving what we believe to be true but don't know to be true. That, I think, is a ploy of religious fundamentalists. But for a reputable scientist to say that, I think really is quite disgraceful. So I'm leading you now, as we go into awareness of awareness, clearly on the path of heresy. Because it's going against the grain of the entire 20th century, and it's trying to make up for tragic mistakes made back in the 17th century by philosophers and theologians alike. And so what is the very nature of a consciousness? It is luminosity. I think these views here are the very epitome of darkness. And so before we go in, I will say, come to the light. Let us settle the body, speech, and mind in their natural states, calming the mind for a few minutes with mindfulness of breathing. then let your eyes be at least partially open. And bring both your visual gaze and your mental awareness into the space in front of you. And without taking anything as an object, without focusing on anything, simply rest your awareness in the space in front of you. And simply remain present, taking nothing as an object. Sustain your mindfulness without distraction and without grasping onto anything at all. And now alternate between simply resting your awareness, still quite present, but not fiercely concentrated. And then concentrate, bring your awareness tightly into the present moment. Focus sharply, taking no object, but you can still focus your attention. Bring it immediately into the present moment. And then relax, focus and relax. At your own pace, in conjunction with the breath, if you find it helpful, as a preliminary phase. Whatever thoughts arise, release them instantly. Maintain a flow of perceptual awareness. As free of filtering by concepts and ideas as possible. And then begin a new oscillation, turning your attention away from all appearances, including the appearance of space itself. Turning your awareness inwards, right in upon the nature of the consciousness itself. Arouse, focus, concentrate as you retract the antenna of your attention in upon the sheer experience of being conscious, cognizant, and clear. Then release your awareness into space while gently sustaining the flow of awareness, arousing and releasing, arousing and releasing. Let's continue practicing in silence. bring the session to a close. So to my mind, what we are doing here is quite consciously and deliberately subversive, to really challenge, I'll do everything I possibly can to try to ignite a revolution against what I think is an ideological and methodological tyranny. First of all, superimposed or imposed upon the scientific community, of course, the methodological and ideological tyranny of this metaphysical dogma of scientific materialism, which is terribly hampering, limiting the scientific imagination, both for ideas as well as methods. But it doesn't stop there. If it just stopped there, I'd say, well, that's too bad for the scientists. But this same dogma dominates modern education, it dominates modern medicine, it dominates the media, and in communist countries, it's become, for all practical purposes, the state religion. And a study was done, a panel was held just a few weeks ago, it was reported in the New York Times, about the 13 most oppressive countries in the world in terms of oppressing religious freedom. Lo and behold, communist countries figured very prominently. So I think this is utterly tragic, and it started with behaviorism and the seeds of it, of basically turning us inside out. There is no interiority. There is no interiority. Ideas, beliefs, sensations, expectations doesn't exist at all. All we are bodies of flesh with behavioral dispositions. Mind was reduced to a behavioral disposition. Even later, it was then said to be, well, okay, but it's illusory. Okay, it exists subjective, but it's illusory. It's of no account. You don't need to look at it. It's illusory. It's misleading. So don't bother with it. And now we have the same thing coming out of neuroscience as saying, well, what's real is the brain. So just as one prominent neuroscientist said, if you want to study meditation, the only way to understand how meditation works is by understanding its biological mechanisms. Turn meditation inside out and have it simply displayed as neuronal activity. This ideology is gutting us, and it is championing an I-it relationship, that we are merely behavior, we are merely robots that display behavior with behavior, and our programs are the so-called mind. We are merely brains, and all of our subjective experiences simply consist of neural patterns. It's championing that which is most abhorrent to all contemplative traditions of the world, and that is an I-you relationship, an I-thou relationship, taking the subjectivity of ourselves and others seriously, and it's stamping on that. And we see it manifesting in medicine, and it's utterly tragic. So I do speak with passion, but it's not. I don't think it is simply. It would be easy to say, oh, you're just clinging to your views. Okay, fair enough. If this were just views against views, who cares? It's just views. But this view is doing terrible damage. This ideological dogma is doing terrible damage. And it's time to stage a revolution. So contemplatives of the world, unite. You have only your illusions of knowledge to lose. Let's go. Let's practice.